All units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
I'm calling for an audit of every single penny that has been sent to Ukraine, including aid money and any other monies that have been given to the Ukrainian government to defend their national security, where our national security has been ignored. This must be done. It has to be done as soon as possible for the American people. They deserve transparency, and they deserve to see where their money is going.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, you were speaking of her in laudable terms the other day. The controversial Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think it's because she's focusing on this issue that deserves some attention. And you did one of your two-minute videos this week, which people can see at Scott Ritter Extra, on this very issue of auditing, scrutinizing how money sent to Ukraine is being spent. You're perfectly comfortable praising Marjorie Taylor Greene, the controversial Marjorie Taylor Greene, MTG, when she deserves it, correct?
I'll praise anybody when they articulate sound policy, and she's articulating sound policy. It's probably the most sane thing she said, and she's on target.
All right. You can check that out, like I said, at Scott Ritter Extra. Also, we have a couple of new posts that were just published. It's not only Scott who's writing for us. We also have a contribution from Kevin Michalitzi. Big round of applause from Maverick for Kevin Michalitzi, an information warfare specialist. And you can check out what he wrote. And then just published moments ago, our favorite weapons inspector describes how Pink Floyd's music affected him deeply. And this is a follow-up to a discussion that Scott had with the legendary co-founder of Pink Floyd, Roger Waters, on Randy Credico's recent episode.
Yes. I played fanboy on that episode and missed my opportunity to speak to him in a meaningful fashion about his music, so I was just following up on that, just so he knows that when I said that the album had a deep impact on me, I really meant it. I wasn't just being a gushing, fan who always says that, I'm sure he has 1,000 people every day, your music has been more meaningful to me than life itself, which maybe it has, but with me, it truly did have a impact. The dogs are having a good time right now.
Yeah, I guess so. And I know exactly what you mean. I mean, anybody who reads this article will see you're not just saying, hey, man, great song. You go into great detail about how the lyrics affected you. And I think it's a very moving piece. And I think everyone will enjoy it greatly. All right. So we get straight to the questions. Or is there any news that you want to mention? Do we know who is responsible for that errant missile yet?
Well, we know it's Ukraine. We just don't know who in Ukraine. So we're waiting for that.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on. I think we have some news coming in now.
Look at it. Are you saying Alec Baldwin did it?
I'm not saying. I mean, this is just coming off the wire. So we'll have to look into the authenticity of that report. Seems a little suspicious, but you never know. All right. Let's go to St. Petersburg from Yaroslav. According to official statements, Russia has mobilized 300,000 men. However, I have inside, not me, but this person, Yaroslav, has inside information that we have mobilized 1.5 million. Colonel Douglas McGregor already mentioned a million on one of his shows. Your thoughts on this?
I don't have any information to back that up. I have no reason to believe the Russian government is lying. 300,000 was the number set forth by the president. It was an official number. And the various governors who have been responding to it seem to be responding to the 300,000 number, not something that would be five times greater than that. That's my marine math. I imagine that five times 300,000 would be 1.5 million. I don't see any evidence to back that up. That's a lot of men, and it would be not, it's not something that would be readily, you know, overlooked. There would be a lot of wives and you know, daughters and moms saying, where the hell are our men going? I do believe that there have been, in addition to the 300,000, you know, anywhere between 90 and 110,000 volunteers in, you know, above and beyond 300,000. But even 1 million is, it's a big number. We'll find out, but you know, I don't have any information, and I don't have any, you know, data points or videos or anything that I can grab onto and say, yeah, this is good. I'm not doubting the gentleman's word, and I'm not doubting Colonel McGregor's analysis. I'm just saying that I don't have anything to go on. So I'm going to stick with the, official government numbers right now and until proven otherwise.
All right. I'm sure somebody will distort that into saying that Scott viciously defamed Colonel McGregor.
Oh, well, no, I didn't.
of course you didn't. I know you didn't. Okay. Let's go to the next question. We can come back to that, Tori. Galina from Canada, who complained that her questions are being ignored on the very day that one of her questions was included. That was a first time. So now another question from my friend Galena. But she did make a good point. She says that when I say we, it's our last question, it kind of sounds like we have no more questions. I don't want to mislead people. What I mean is that it's the end of the time period that we have allocated for the submitted questions. And then we take some live questions also. We do it for 2 hours on Friday night and another hour on Tuesday. So I think we're doing the best we can, and I hope Galena understands now, and I hope we cleared that up. Is Putin's best friend Erdogan a friend or a parasite? Erdogan did not support him after the Black Sea attack. He still sells drones to Ukraine and is set to join new sanctions on Russian soil. Why doesn't Putin place at least some conditions on their cooperation?
Because strategically, Putin and Russia are getting more out of a constructive relationship with Erdogan than they would by confronting and doing what the United States does, which is put conditions on everything. You know, yes, in a perfect world, you know, Putin and Russia would say that the, you know, some of Turkey's actions are incompatible with good relations, but we're not in a perfect world. We're in a very complicated world. One where Russia is getting a lot from the Turkish relationship that they wouldn't otherwise get. For instance, you have, you know, a Nord Stream. You know, as soon as Nord Stream shut down, now Turkey's talking about Turk Stream. Turkey is building a Russian, or Russia's building a nuclear power plant, and in Turkey, and there's, you know, economic interaction taking place. Turkey is a useful diplomatic partner. I'd have to go in and check on what Turkey's doing about oil. I would be surprised, to be honest, if Turkey was jumping on the oil sanctions bandwagon, especially anything dealing with a price cap, given what Russia has said about nations who participate in the price cap. But we'll see. I mean, that if that's what Turkey's doing, it might be a red line that that you know Russia will hold them to account. But I just think that Russia takes a strategic look here. It's not a zero-sum game. And when Russia looks at the balance sheet, they're getting more from their current relationship with with Turkey than they would be if they put conditions and you know, stopped cooperating with Turkey on some very important issues.
Okay. And let's move on to the next question. We're going to go to Australia now. Cupidus Passis, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Is it true that Russia will struggle to supply Crimea due to the Kerch Bridge damage, lack of military trucks hit by javelins, and long, efficient land bridge paths?
No. Russia will supply Crimea just fine. It's a strategic piece of territory. And, you know, remember, while the one lane of the road is down, the trains are working and you ship more via trains than you do via trucks. The Russians have this under control. They're repairing the bridge as they speak, but in the meantime, sufficient logistics support is getting through to Crimea. Neither the people nor the military are going to suffer.
Okay. And we have a voicemail message from Ryan Milton in Austin. Apparently, there's been some, I thought, good-natured give and take going on your Telegram, having to do with some macho posturing. But I don't know, maybe it's not so good-natured. It appears that he's issuing some sort of a challenge. Let's give this a listen.
Okay, Mr. Ritter, Mr. Scott Ritter, I've been hearing all these things you've been saying about me on your shows and showing your guns and challenge accepted on your Telegram channel. You want to wrestle me? Wrestle me New York style? Well, I'm not afraid of you. Now, it's true, I only arm wrestle women, but I've only arm wrestled women who are a lot bigger and a lot stronger than you, maybe even smarter, because you're from New York City. Whoever ate salsa from New York City out there, woods in New York. So I'm from Texas, and I say the way to win is brains and Texas muscle, rootin', tootin', cowboy arms and leather boots. You might be flexing, but I'm going to win because I fought women bigger than you. You bit off more than you can chew, and I'm going to wipe the floor with you when you come here to Texas this coming year. Come on over here if you dare.
All right. We are working on a scheduling events in Austin in March. And do you accept the arm wrestling challenge?
I don't know. That was pretty intimidating. I'm a little nervous right now. I'm going to have to get back to you on Jeff. My cowardism, the yellow streak that's been, hell yeah, I accept it. God, arm wrestling a Texan. That's like stealing candy from a baby. Jesus.
All right, it's on. We just need to set a date and a venue. Ryan Milton versus Scott Ritter, arm wrestling, Austin, Texas, circa March 23.
I need another month to train.
You need what?
I need another month to train.
Oh, no, no. You're ready. Don't be shy. Okay. So circa, by the way, is Latin for approximately, I think. So let's move on to our next question. Oh, speaking of Austin, Ryan's neighbor, maybe, Greg S. Was it a mistake for Russia to take Kherson in the first place without sufficient support to hold it in the face of potential NATO counterattacks? Or was Russia's taking of Kherson appropriate and based upon some sound military doctrine?
Well, Kherson is a regional center. Possessing Kherson and the territory that they possessed gave Russia at least a legitimate foundation upon which to carry out the referendum that they did. Had they not taken the city, had they not occupied the territory on the west side of the bank, it might have been difficult for them to say, I'm going to have a referendum in Kherson since they don't control Kherson. So at the time the referendum was done, Russia was in control of Kherson. The Kherson bridgehead makes sense if you're going to drive on Mykolaiv and maybe make a pivot towards Odessa. But when the Russian offense stalled and the Ukrainians began to counterattack, the bridgehead no longer held the same strategic incentives to hold that had been previously. And so Russia took a strategic decision to withdraw to the other side of the Dnieper River, dig in. And I think the Russians are pretty certain that Kherson will be Russian soon, and with it, a lot of other territory. So I think the Russians did the right thing. I don't think there was a mistake here. Right. I ain't jello wrestling, all right. You know, but he's probably like 3'6". I mean, then his guns aren't that impressive. That's all I'm going to say.
That's true. Height and leverage are definite factors in arm wrestling. David from Copenhagen. How likely is it that Russia shared their hypersonic technology with China and perhaps Iran as part of their strategy to make a multipolar world a reality?
Highly unlikely. Both Iran and China have their own advanced defense industries. I think we see that Iran is coming into its own. The fact that Iran is selling you know, drone technology to Russia underscores the fact that Iran is a force we contend with. You know, you go to the International Math Olympics every year, and it's China and Iran that are taking the top positions. So I think they are fully capable of carrying out the complex mathematical calculations necessary to conceptualize hypersonics. And the Chinese have been building hypersonics for many years now, and so have the so have the Iranians. I mean, the Russians, of course, have an edge, but you know, the hypersonic warheads that Russia's developing are designed for Russian systems, whereas, you know, and the Chinese are designed to Chinese systems and the Iranians for Iranian systems. They're three different families of weapons, so three different approaches. I don't think it's about the three nations sharing the most sensitive technologies that they possess.
Okay. And I should probably explain to folks who aren't familiar with our format or the two different formats. On Tuesdays, we do what we call the lightning round. And that is the program in which Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. And we try to get to some of the questions we're not able to get to on Friday night, which is the loquacious version, the more expansive two-hour version. All right, let's go on to the next question. Carlos Munoz, it's not who you know, it's who Munoz. I don't know. I think there was a joke in there somewhere, but it got lost about halfway out. Can you provide or point to a graphic of the ballistic vectors of Russian attacks, legitimate Ukrainian counterattacks, and the probable actual trajectory of the missile that landed in Poland? This would help convince people that it was not unintentional.
One, it's not my job to convince people about anything regarding this attack. So, I'm not being mean to Carlos. I understand your question, but I'm under no obligation to do anything. It's quite obvious what happened. I mean, Carlos, I will ask you this. Do your research. You'll see that the targets that Russia hit that day are named. Plot them on a map. Then do the research about what the S-300 range is. And from that target, plot various engagement arcs. For that, and you'll get a possible location of the missiles that could have engaged. And then ask yourself how a missile that's engaging a missile coming in at that particular target can make its way to Poland. And you'll see where I'm coming from. But, you know, I don't have a NATO command and control screen. I don't have the sources of intelligence. I don't have, that which you're asking for. I can do what you're saying, and I have done it. The concept that I have to provide a graphic representation of my analysis for questions like this, I'd be doing it all day then. I'd never get anything done. If you want to challenge me, I mean, we put a challenge down, bet a beer, and I bet you I can produce a graphic that proves my point. But since I'm not in Arizona and you're not here, that beer would be a long time coming.
I think you should arm wrestle him. Can make that, you know, your new thing.
I saved myself. I can only wrestle one person at a time.
Well, I didn't say simultaneously with Ryan. One at a time, indeed. Barbara P. from New Jersey. It seems that Eastern NATO nations, Poland and friends, are trying to force the rest of NATO, i.e. the U.S., into an open war with Russia. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, we'll start off with the understanding that NATO doesn't appear to be seeking a straight up war with Russia. Even Poland, I guess there was the prank call by these two Russian pranksters pretending to be Emmanuel Macron speaking to the Polish president. And the president believed that he was Macron. And so he had a very frank conversation with him where he said, "I'm not looking for a war with Russia." And I believe him. The problem is that they are looking for a NATO-backed no-fly zone over Ukraine. Some people are under the impression that Russia is bluffing, that Russia won't confront a NATO no-fly zone. And so what this whole Polish missile thing did is start to put in place the pieces necessary for that. For the first time, NATO has deployed the Patriot surface-to-air missile defense system. These are two German batteries to the Ukrainian-Polish border. So now the umbrella of air defense coverage actually extends well into East Ukraine, into West Ukraine. And that's the beginning. Now, to be look, if you're a Russian Air Force officer planning a strike, you now have to take into account the NATO air defense umbrella, which means you must have a package in reserve ready to strike these two places in case they engage. That's just the reality of war. So now we have the Russians actively plotting strikes against NATO air defense, who are actively plotting defenses against Russian aircraft. That's sort of like one step before war. And we're going to have tens of millions of Ukrainians possibly heading to the Polish-Ukrainian border because they're refugees in a country that can't keep them warm. And when that happens, Poland's not going to let them in. And so there's going to be a humanitarian crisis that screams for humanitarian intervention, which will demand a no-fly zone, which will require air defense assets that extend into Ukraine, and they're already deployed. So we're just inching our way towards a problem.
Okay. Somebody was asking where they can get a T-shirt. The thing is, our vendor in New York stole our money. I think, so far as I know, everybody who ordered a T-shirt and paid for it got it, but they haven't paid us. So we need to look for a new vendor, which is worth doing, because that is one good-looking T-shirt. So as soon as we have a new situation, and for now I won't name this vendor, but they deserve something bad, like maybe a guy from Africa, Botswana. I just saw a video where you said Poles and Americans are not going to attack because they don't have a sustainability factor. What did you mean by this phrase, sustainability factor?
Well, militaries march on their stomachs. They require ammunition and fuel to fight and move. They require spare parts. All of this is logistics that have to be stored in warehouses, that have to be equipped, staffed. You have to have a system that transports from the warehouse to the front line, et cetera, combat service support. Normally, if you're going to deploy a force forward like this, you're going to deploy a significant, either you're going to deploy significant combat service support, or it's going to already be in existence. There isn't sufficient combat service support to keep an American armored brigade in combat for a sufficient period of time. They're going to burn through their ammunition expenditure rates, going to far exceed their resupply capability. Petroleum, oil, and lubricants are not sufficiently forward deployed. There isn't a sufficient distribution mechanism, so they'll run out of gas. It's just, war is a serious business, and logistics sort of determines who's going to win and lose a war. And right now we don't have the ability to sustain. And the other aspect of sustain is to ensure that your burn rate on the front line does not exceed your ability to replenish. And this includes tanks, armored fighting vehicles, men, helicopters. One thing this Ukraine conflict should have taught everybody is that war is hell. This ain't Afghanistan. This ain't Iraq. This isn't a couple dozen people dying a month. This is thousands of people dying a day, heavy combat, and it's going to get even worse. And you want to throw the United States and Poland into this meat grinder? Okay, but understand that when you throw meat into a meat grinder, you get ground beef. So you better have more meat to throw in there or you're going to be left with nothing. And neither Poland nor the United States is equipped and prepared to sustain large ground forces and large-scale ground combat in Europe against a Russian-type foe. That's what I meant by it.
All right. And I assume that was an abbreviated list of the things that are essential for sustainability. I noticed you didn't mention decent wine, for example, full body
for
massage.
Marines, I didn't mention crayons. We have to have crayons for Marines.
All right. And a little something to drink on special occasions. I learned that from watching MASH. I mean, Hawkeye.
That's Army, man. Oh, that's right. Oh, we're talking about the Army.
Let's go to Hawaii and catch a wave. Jonathan Quail Higgins, the third of the Hawaiian Higgins. Do you know this person? Is that why you're reacting?
Magnum PI, baby.
Oh, okay. Is that a character?
Yeah.
Higgins. Oh, okay. So I'm not familiar with Magnum. I get it now. All right. France's clown in chief, Macron the first, threw a hissy fit. Australia would enter nuclear confrontation with China by choosing U.S.-made nuclear subs instead of French-made diesel subs. Is this a sore loser's argument or a serious one?
It's a sore loser's argument. I mean, it's not that, the problem with Australia choosing a nuclear-powered sub, do you remember when he says nuclear sub, it's not a nuclear weapon sub, it's not nuclear-armed, it's nuclear-powered. And the French sub that they were choosing was a design for a nuclear power plant, but converted to a diesel plant, because the problem is Australia isn't a nuclear power, doesn't have a nuclear energy program, doesn't have a relationship with the International Atomic Energy Agency, and doesn't have a safeguards plan. And now overnight, Australia is going to become a nuclear capable state. What I mean by that is they're going to have a nuclear reactor, nuclear material, etc. It's an open violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But that's not going to create a nuclear conflict with China. China will sink all of Australia's submarines straight up. Australia, I'm just telling you, I know you guys, oh my God, Scott, our submarines, they could sneak into Chinese harbors and take beautiful, lovely pictures. And they did. I'll give you that. That was the old China. This is the new China. And New China's got good submarines too. And New China's been looking at you, and New China's ready to take you on. And so you'll spend all your money on these submarines, and they'll sink, and you'll lose all your people. That's just a fact. So I don't know why Australia did this, because they're scared to tell the United States no. Perhaps it's not going to make Australia any more relevant in the Pacific. The total number of submarines that Australia is purchasing is a drop in the bucket compared to what China has and what the United States needs. So this is literally Australia being dumber than dirt.
Okay. I remember that saying, dumber than dirt. That's a good one. San from India. What were the reasons for the Soviet divide, according to the Soviet people you visited or spoke to at the time? Was language one of the reasons?
Soviet divide? I don't understand the question, I guess.
Move on.
Perestroika problems? I'll try and answer it. I'm not being disrespectful. For divisions within the Soviet Union, the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed, I don't think it's Sino-Soviet, because diplomats always find a way around language. I think language is the issue. The Soviet Union was a nation that was, it had a lot of languages, but almost everybody spoke Russian. So it wasn't a language problem. It might have been I think economics was the big one that, at the end of the day, when the Communist Party stopped being the big thing that destroyed the Soviet Union is when Russia, the Russian Federation, said it's going to tax itself and budget itself, and it's not going to continue to support the Communist Party. And once you withdrew Russia from the Communist Party, the Communist Party had no power, because Russia was the Communist Party. Russia funded it. Russia provided the structure. The Soviet Union was ostensibly this overarching mechanism over this federation of Soviet socialist republics. But really, it was Russia doing all that. I mean, playing a game, you're saying, the Soviet Union was Russia. But when Yeltsin came in, Yeltsin said, no, Russia is Russia. The Soviet Union is something different. And as soon as he did that, the Communist Party and the Soviet authority was severely diminished, and that was the beginning of the end. The lack of absolute economic control and the power that accrues is what brought the Soviet down. I think I answered the question.
All right, way to go. Alan, Stockport, Great Britain, can you expand on your time in Vietnam?
I've never been to Vietnam.
I've never heard you say that either, so I was wondering.
My father served in Vietnam, and I said that we played host to Vietnamese refugees in 1975. But I personally have never been to Vietnam. I'd love to go to Vietnam, but I've never been to Vietnam.
All right, so the answer to that question is no. Edward, who describes himself as a Russian living in the United Kingdom. That's Great Britain, Scott, in case you didn't know. Colonel Douglas McGregor said that before Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union was preparing to invade Germany, and Germany just had to wait another year for the attack. Is this true? Why would Soviets want to invade Germany?
Well, remember, the Soviet Union was communist. and the Nazis were oppressing the Communist Party. But there's no doubt that the Soviets were in the process of building up a massive military presence on their western borders. Large scale armored formations, et cetera, were being formed up. I'd have to go back and triple check the history. I'm not going to sit here and say that Colonel McGregor's wrong, because I know I've read that, some people have interpreted the buildup to indicate that the Soviet Union was going to invade, but the Soviet Union doesn't have a history of invading people. I guess Afghanistan, but there was a reason. There was a cause effect relationship. So just out of the blue to attack Germany, they'd have to go through Poland. There's not a direct conduit between the Soviet Union and Germany. So I'd have to go and double check the history, whether or not the Russians were prepared to receive an attack and then counterattack. But it just wasn't part of the Soviet way of doing business to just straight up invade for no reason. So okay. I'd have to check.
And speaking of your willingness to do research, sometimes when folks ask things that you're not familiar with, that reminds me. I think there was a question last time about, was it Peter Zeihan? Do you remember?
Peter Zeihan. Well, they asked if I was familiar with him. The answer is no. I have since looked him up. He's a former vice president analyst for Stratfor, which is a Texas-based geopolitical analysis intelligence company. And he's written extensively on a number of issues. I'm not familiar with his work. I mean, I haven't read it, but I have no reason to doubt his expertise or, his professionalism when it comes to analysis. I can't say that I agree or disagree because I haven't. All I did is find out who the guy was. I didn't take the time to immerse myself in his writing. There was another guy, too, Timothy Snyder, I think they asked me about. He's a Yale history professor. And I will say this. I mean, it's funny. I saw this this meme. I don't know if it's a meme, but it was a slide of a single brain cell seeking to establish connectivity. So you see all the little things go out trying to find something to connect with. And that was my brain when somebody said Timothy Snyder. I'm sitting there going, I know what this is, and it's reaching out, but I can't get any connectivity. But now that I did it, I go, I know who he is. Yeah, he's a Yale historian, and I don't agree with anything he writes. I don't like his approach. I think he's wrong on Putin. I think he's wrong on Russia. I mean, the fact that he starts off an article in Foreign Affairs magazine that Russia is an aging tyranny and Ukraine is a young, vibrant democracy just tells you right off the bat that this guy is not doing well in the head.
All right.
But he teaches it. Yeah.
But you're open to being impressed by Peter Zeihan if you were to become more familiar with him. And did you say his company is based in Texas? Is that what I heard?
No, he used to be a vice president of Stratfor, but today I think he's just an independent geopolitical analyst.
Oh, okay. He's not in Texas, or you don't know where he is now?
I don't know where he is. Yeah.
All right. I'm just looking for an excuse to mention Texas so we can keep promoting the event, the arm wrestling match. I'm like the Don King of modern times. Minus the hair. Okay, let's go to Dinara, Portland, Oregon. As a Russian woman married to an American man, I feel torn knowing that my husband's taxes go to Ukraine in order to attack Russians. What would you recommend to such wives? Marital advice from the weapons inspector, just what we need. That's what the show was lacking. What kind of future presidents would you like to see for both our countries?
I'll answer the second part first. For Russia, I don't care. I'm not a Russian. I would like to see a president that isn't hostile to the United States. And just generally speaking, I think the Russian people would like to see a president that puts Russian interests first and foremost. I will say this about Vladimir Putin. Whatever you want to say about him, good, bad, indifferent, he saved Russia. Russia was going down the toilet of life in 1999, heading in the wrong direction. The trajectory was all wrong. And Vladimir Putin saved Russia. So no matter what you think of the guy today, he's done this, that, and the other thing. Without him, you wouldn't be where you're at. Okay, Russia has improved. There's not one area in Russian life that's worse today than it was in 1999 when Putin took over. So I think the Russians should be very satisfied with their leadership. If Russia wants to improve democracy, pro-hint. Don't criticize your president as much. Just stop taking money from the United States, because when you take money from the United States, you're taking money from the CIA. When you take money from Great Britain, you're taking money from the MI6. And they're not looking out for Russia's best interests. They're trying to get you to do something that undermines Putin, therefore undermines Russia, and therefore weakens Russia. I think it's great to have a viable democratic opposition. I think political competition is absolutely essential. And I think Putin would agree with me that Russia benefits by having a viable political opposition, but not one that's controlled by outside powers who don't have Russia's best interests at heart. The U.S. and Great Britain want Russia to return to the 1990s. And if any Russian out there wants to return to the 1990s, I think that says a lot about them. So there's that about taxes and such. Man, you know, if you're going to go crazy over where your taxes go, going to Russia or going to Ukraine is the least of your problems. The U.S. government wastes our taxpayers' money all over the place. We waste it here at home. We waste it abroad. And I think every American would like to see, budgets that take better care of America, American infrastructure, America health, things of that nature than wasting it on frivolous programs here and throwing it away, supporting neo-Nazis in Ukraine. What can you do about it? Get involved politically. Start working with your local people that, pick better politicians, pick better leaders, help get them voted in office. God, Jeff, I hate you.
That's the 30-second warning. All right, you're done. All right.
But I'm so proud of never getting that noise.
I'm not sure if that qualifies as marital advice, but okay, close enough.
Well, it saves a marriage. Don't talk about money. It's the best way to save a marriage. Don't talk about money.
Don't talk about it. Just assume that the finances will be managed properly. Right?
Correct. Or if you're the husband, just give total control of the finances to the wife and never ask a question.
All right. There you go. Tommy O'Dwyer. Perhaps that's it. Brisbane, Australia. Given that Russia executed an orderly withdrawal from the northern western bank of the Dnieper River, why do you think they haven't shelled advancing Ukrainian forces from the other side of the river?
Well, there's no doubt they're shelling Ukrainian forces. Maybe the question is, why aren't they shelling the city of Kherson? And I don't understand. Thank you. I won't never.
I think what that might have been the question. Is that the person who asked the question?
I don't know.
I think that's the person whose question you answered thanking you, I believe. Is that right, Tori?
I think so. I don't have the question up, but I think you're right.
Well, yeah. I'm under the clock under this question, so I better hurry. I don't think they've shelled Kherson, because Kherson is the capital of that district. And they're not going to destroy a city that they plan on reoccupying, at least not intentionally destroy that city. But they are shelling the Ukrainians elsewhere in Kherson. Ukrainian troop concentrations, command and control, logistic hubs are all being shelled by the Russians on a daily basis. Unless the Russians are lying, I read their reports, and it indicates that the Russians are actively seeking to destroy Ukrainian capabilities through the application of intense artillery fire. They're just not going to destroy the city of Kherson, because that's the regional capital and they plan on recapturing it soon.
Okay. And it was, there you go. That commenter was a woman named Dinara saying thank you. I guessed correctly. All right. Why don't we take some live questions now? Tori, you got some good ones for us?
Yeah, I've been collecting them. Let's see here. All right. Here's Paul Wolf.
By the way, Tori was in Boston for Scott's event Saturday night. How did that go for you two? Did you get along okay? Any quarreling or anything?
It was a ton of fun. I had a great time.
I don't like her at all, Jeff. I don't know why you got her involved in this program. It was just disruptive. She refused to help. She just showed up. She was like a prima donna. All she wanted to do was hang around, have people take their pictures with her. And then when I wanted to sneak away, she was like, but aren't you going to buy me dinner? And so I had to take her out. She was horrible company. Wow. God. No, I'm joking. It was wonderful. She was a great help.
So demanding.
She was the headline speaker. And the event would not have been a success without her. So thank you, Tori. I really appreciate everything you did.
Thank you. That was, yeah. I, like I said, I had a blast.
Oh, so you're out of time, Tori. was Scott a total gentleman? And did he treat you well?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We got dinner at this Asian place with two other people. Yeah, it was really good. Great time.
All right. So let's see what we have in the way of questions from the audience. Scott's next live events will be in Ann Arbor, Michigan, by the way, on December 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Okay. Oh, sorry. I got 10 things going on at once. Sorry about that. I had the clock still running. Paul Wolf.
PTSD, Jeff. PTSD. I warned you about this.
We can change the tone to something more soothing if you'd like. Paul Wolf, what's the relationship between FTX, Ukraine, and the Democratic Party? Does crypto make it easier for people to embezzle and launder money?
The second part of the question, I don't know because I don't know anything about crypto. I really don't. Maybe I should. Maybe that's a major gap in my understanding, but I don't know anything about crypto. And so for all those people on my Telegram channel that get messages from people who pretend to me and they're asking about crypto, pro hint, Scott Ritter, don't ask anybody about crypto because Scott Ritter don't know anything about crypto. I'm dumber than dirt. First part of the question, what's the relationship? You know, that's one of the best questions out there because it just looks bad. I I'm not a criminal investigator. I don't know what's going on. But when the U.S. government under Democratic Party leadership sends billions of dollars to Ukraine, and then Ukraine sets up a relationship with FTX to somehow send money to FTX, and then FTX sends millions of dollars in donations to the Democratic Party, that just looks like a little money laundering scheme. I mean, there's just something wrong with it. Now, maybe I got the facts wrong. This is what I'm gleaning from the news. Maybe there's a legitimate explanation. Somebody was talking about it on the radio and, they made it sound like maybe everything could have been on the up and up, that the Ukrainians, although they started this thing with FTX, didn't follow through completely. I don't know. I don't know anything. I'm just saying that it looks like a duck. It quacks like a duck. It walks like a duck. So it's a duck. And I think it's money laundering. That's
all right. Speaking of Telegram, I'm getting people complaining about this and that. Some are going on about the imposters and the scams going on. I know you're aware of that, but I'm also getting people who complain that the moderators are banning them and they're appealing to me. And I'm saying, well, I don't know anything about it. I'm not even involved. Is there a way that the people can have their appeals heard when they're banned from your Telegram?
Well, first of all, let me put it this way. The Telegram channel was created. Am I on the clock here? Am I going to get buzzed?
No.
Send me to the hospital. The Telegram channel was created by request. I didn't want to create it. The last thing I wanted to get involved in was a chat room. But someone said, Scott, you post your stuff there, but then nobody has a chance to respond to it. And there's a lot of people who have questions. They want comments and all that. So I created the channel. And the sole purpose of the channel was for people to talk about what I wrote or videos I made, to make comments. If they want to have an internal discussion about it, that's fine, as long as it's done civilly. And it doesn't turn into what happens on a whole bunch of other Telegram channels, into, people being anti-Semitic, people making racial statements, people slamming the United States, people slamming Russia. That's not the purpose of it. So the moderators help keep the room civil. I've delegated a lot of authority and responsibility. They know what my intent is and they respect that intent. Sometimes we get a little punch drunk. We're only human. And so, I don't mind humor. I don't mind people, having, polite conversation back and forth. As long as people aren't spamming porn or, things like that, that'll get you banned. I don't believe that the admins ban people without a warning. So if you're banned, that means you probably got a warning and they probably warned you about something. Like, for instance, I know the other day somebody posted something about U.S. soldiers in Poland. They showed a video clip of U.S. soldiers walking through a mall and being harassed by a guy who was attacking a Hispanic American and a Black American making the most awful racial statements imaginable and mocking the soldiers, etc. And somebody made a comment about, you know, American heroes, and I told them to cease and desist. You know, this ain't Twitter. I'm not Elon Musk pretending this is free speech. If you operate within the parameters that are set, it is free speech. But I'm an American. Those are my fellow service members, and they didn't do a damn thing to anybody. They were walking through a mall, minding their own business, and they were harassed by a racist thug. And they're lucky they didn't kill him. But they're on their best behavior, and he knew it. That's why he was provoking them. And I don't want that stuff on my channel. So if you're going to post something that's anti-American, and again, Jeff knows, I criticize my government all the time. My government isn't America. My government isn't my country. You can criticize my government. You can speak factually about my country. You know, we're not perfect, and it's okay to say we're not perfect and say why you think they're not perfect. But I'm not going to sit by while you just take cheap shots at men and women who had the courage to serve their country in uniform. Okay,
you've described the ground rules, but the question remains unanswered. If somebody is banned for a reason they feel is wrong, meaning they feel they did not commit one of the no-nos, but they were banned anyway, is there a way for them to appeal that decision?
I mean, there's no formal process. People have reached out to me, and I've reached out to the admins. And to be honest, 100% of the time that somebody reached out and said they feel they were banned unfairly, we let them back in. But at some point in time, that just becomes disrespectful to the admins. They made a decision. It's a command decision. And unless I want to second guess everything they do, I have to live with their decision. These are good people who are given a lot of time and effort to keeping the chat room functional. If you honestly think that you did nothing wrong, if you honestly think, I mean, the rules are right there. If you think you didn't swear, if you don't think you weren't anti-Semitic, if you don't think that you attacked the United States unfairly and all that stuff, then find me and send me a direct message and say, hey, I feel like I was unfairly banned, and I'll look at it and I'll try and do my best. But, you know, do I really
want to? Okay, there you have it. I think that's a good answer. And I've been telling people that it's up to you, and I promised them that I would check with you. So we've done it. And so email us through scottritterextra.com. And if somebody who's banned has an appeal that looks reasonable, I will forward it to Scott. All right, let's go back to the questions. Thank you, Scott, for clearing that up. What exactly does the AFU gain by dragging NATO into this conflict, knowing it will escalate and destroy Ukraine regardless?
Well, first of all, the armed forces of Ukraine, the AFU, I think has come to the conclusion they're going to lose this war. So what benefit do they get by dragging NATO in? That's their only hope of not losing this war, is that NATO intervened and somehow through that intervention prevent Russia from destroying Ukraine. But right now, Russia is going to destroy the Ukrainian military. Demilitarization means just that. The Ukrainian burn rate is much higher than their replenishment rate, which means they're getting weaker every day. And Russia's about to receive at least 300,000. Well, they've already received 87,000, but at least 220,000 fresh troops next month. According to some, maybe up to 1.5 million. But the point is, they're going to get a lot of troops with a lot of equipment that are fresh. And Ukraine won't have anything to stop them. So Ukraine's only hope is to, if they win an arm wrestle against me, if you can beat me in arm wrestling and you didn't say something anti-Semitic or, spam porn, if you didn't do something that I wouldn't want to hang around with you anyways, if it was just an honest disagreement, yeah, if you can beat me in arm wrestling, you're back in the room. That's a stand. That's a rule. But the point is, that's our only hope. I actually believe a lot of people believe that Russia's bluffing, that Russia won't confront NATO, that if NATO intervened in a way that established some sort of buffer, that Russia would back off. I think they're wrong, but we'll never know unless it happens. And apparently the Ukrainians are more than happy to let it try and happen.
Okay. What's your thoughts on the Associated Press firing two journalists over the attack on Poland?
Well, I didn't know about the second journalist, but doesn't surprise me. James LaPorta was the journalist in question. I've always had a problem with his reporting. It seemed to be very biased. I've read his stuff, and you know, he just cherry picks data. And here he committed an egregious sin that embarrassed them. I mean, the AP apparently doesn't have a problem with people publishing bad information because they published him frequently. But this embarrassed them. They got called out at the highest level, President of the United States. And so they fired him. Good. I wish more journalists lost their jobs when they deliberately distort or lie or manufacture evidence.
All right. And if you want real solid analysis, go to Scott Ritter Extra. There's an example of how we're expanding in that regard. And our next question, is it the natural resources in Ukraine that make it geopolitically a hot spot?
Well, there are significant natural resources, and it ranges from coal to other minerals. It was also, you know, during Soviet times, a lot of industry was created that has been sustained in the defense industry and heavy industry. Plus, it's an agricultural producer. I mean, Ukrainian food, you know, people call it the, you know, one of the breadbaskets of the world, and it is. So there's a lot there that makes Ukraine, you know, viable on the global stage. But it's also, it's where it's geographically located that also creates it. I mean, you know, Ukraine, for instance, before all this happened, they shared the Sea of Azov with Russia, which meant that Ukrainian shipping went through the Kerch Strait. And that was always contentious on the part of Russia. It's on the Black Sea, so it has access to the Black Sea. It's right there in the hub of Europe. And so, you know, stripping that away from Russia, the Russian influence would be, you know, why'd they fire? They never fire editors, but you know, come on, the editor fired him. But I think it's just a Ukraine, you know, there's an interesting book again, Bloodlands, and that might have been Timothy Snyder that wrote it, but I have to go back and look at the title. But it just talks about that area between Western Europe and Russia, where wars have been fought and all this. It's just where it's located makes it a hot spot.
All righty. And on to our next question. Scott, what do you know about the guy that was poisoned who was running against Putin? I forgot his name.
Navalny. How can you forget Navalny's name? Was Navalny ever running against Putin? Because, I mean, in order to run against Putin, you have to have a viable constituency. And I don't think Navalny was ever going to get more low single digits support amongst the Russian people. But whatever happened to him, he's in jail. He's serving a sentence for corruption, embezzlement. What can we say about Navalny? Maybe he started out with good intentions. Maybe he was always, you know, maybe he started out pure. He was an anti-corruption lawyer, and he specialized in bringing, you know, information about Russian corruption to the forefront. So people viewed him as sort of a Edward Snowden, Julian Assange type, you know, truth figure. But at some point he lost his way when he was sent to the United States. I think he went to Yale University to a elite program that is nothing more than a CIA grooming farm. Just look at the man who ran them. I'm sorry. There's no doubt that the CIA recruited Navalny in Yale, 100%. Recruitment. And from that point on, Navalny became a tool of the United States. Therefore, he's a traitor to Russia, and he should be viewed by all Russians as a traitor. This is a man who betrayed his nation, sold his soul for American money, and he continues to do so. He's in jail now. He's lucky the Russians didn't charge him with espionage and treason. Who knows what the future will hold, but he's not a good man. I don't mean that as a person. He might be a good person, but he's not a good man for Russia. He would have, if let's say he was politically viable, if he had been elected, Russia would have returned to the 1990s. And if you're a Russian and that's what you want, then Navalny's your man.
All right. That's it for the lightning round. We do this on Tuesdays for 1 hour. Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. Tori and I will be taking the week off, so no episode of Scenes from the Evolution this week. That means the next time you'll see us will be Friday night for our loquacious version of Ask the Inspector. We will probably have very full bellies the day after Thanksgiving, but I'm sure there will still be fire in the belly, along with all the cranberry sauce, turkey, and everything else. Scott's next live appearances are on December 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in Ann Arbor, Michigan. See you all Friday night. Thank you, Tori. You're the best. Thank you, Scott. You're the best as well. And thanks to our beloved audience. See you Friday
night. Thanks, Jeff. Wait, did you want to ask me a question?
Do you have a book out by any chance? A lot of people have been wondering about that. Oh, I actually have another question while you're promoting that. Can you confirm that you are in receipt of a new camera? Very good. And will you commit to this beloved audience that you will have it attached in time for Friday night's episode so that we will continue to improve and we can see every hair? Yeah, we
I'm
can
pointing see. To a stand over here. I will put this camera on the stand, plug it into this computer, and I'll have it set up so that if you can see me while I see you. And I'm committing to try and do this.
Perfect. And I will make myself available offline for a test if you would like.
But I don't know if I don't know if I have to go this way to set up the camera or. Ryan, this is for you, buddy. I mean,
we'll figure it out. This way, people will see not only the outline of your massive biceps, but they'll see every follicle.
I'm just
going to
say, I'm cramping right now. So.
Just from that alone.
Ryan's like, yeah, I got this.
All right. Well, you have a couple of months or so to train for that. Anyway, Friday night in added clarity with a new camera, thanks to our angel in Quebec.